It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. After a decade as the president of Grinnell College, Raynard Kington is leaving for a position in Massachusetts. Kington will become the new head of school of Phillips Academy. The academy is better known as Andover, the prestigious university preparatory boarding school. Well, let's spend the first half hour today with President Kington to get some of his reflections on his time here in Iowa and the very uncertain times we're experiencing. President Kington, welcome back to our program. So nice to have you with us.
Thank you so much for asking me.
It's been a fast 10 years. I remember when you first became president in August of 2010, you came to our studio and it was so nice meeting you right off the bat then, and it's been a tremendous decade. I wanted to divide this up into some reflections on Grinnell and then a little bit later on COVID, lest we start with COVID and that would just take over the conversation.
Yeah.
So tell us, the announcement that you're leaving Grinnell was at the end of the academic at the end of this academic year, was back in December. Tell us why you decided this is the right step for you now.
Well, first, I think that it's good for healthy institutions to have a reasonable turnover of leadership, and I think 10 years is a good time for colleges and universities. I also think that Grinnell is in a great position, and it just felt right for me and my family, the timing. And I was looking for another challenge. I had I've been approached at various points in time about presidencies of colleges and universities, other colleges and universities, and I just happened to be approached about Phillips Andover. Their search committee they have a tradition of hiring people outside of the usual places for their types of schools. A lot of their heads in the past have come from academia. Their outgoing head was a professor at Harvard Law and is now the head of the MacArthur Foundation, John Palfrey. So I decided to explore it, and it turned out to be a great fit. Off I go.
Off you go. Let's talk about the 10 academic years you've spent in Grinnell or just finishing up now. We're talking to you. You are still in Grinnell. What do you consider,
yeah,
President Kington, to be your greatest achievements while at Grinnell?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. I actually think that question is better answered with some distance.
Okay.
Of time, because it's hard to put things in context. I think I've had a reasonable success in helping the institution prepare for a lot of uncertainty. In many ways, a lot of the work that I and many others did, I didn't do anything by myself. It was really with a great series of board members and with the leadership and incredible faculty. I think our whole community really started planning for a future for the college in a world of a lot of uncertainty, and in many ways that planning positioned us well for COVID-19. So, mm-hmm. So one, sort of helping us sort of build infrastructure and prepare to continue to excel in a world of increased uncertainty in all sorts, and just sort of, I think, helping the institution get on somewhat firmer ground in terms of sort of where it's going and building its place in higher education in the country. So I know that sounds sort of vague.
Mm-hmm. That's all right. Well, let's jump right into it since you touched on the crisis. And our listeners should know, if they don't know already, you have significant health policy expertise, medical expertise. In fact, you became an MD at the age of 21, and prior coming to Grinnell in 2010, you served in a range of positions at the National Institutes of Health. So I want to ask you a little bit about, well, since you broached it, the future of higher ed. You said Grinnell is prepared for it. What are your thoughts now about this curveball, to put it lightly? What do you think about the future of higher education with this pandemic, social distancing, how it's likely to change not only higher education, but how we get educated in our entire society, perhaps?
Yes. So I think that we're going to have a lot of changes in higher ed as a result of the extraordinary stresses that have been placed on our communities writ large, but especially our higher education institutions, because of the pandemic. I think that there are institutions who may not come out of this and continue to open. I think there'll be some institutions that are going to have tremendous trouble with this added burden on top of everything else. We were already at a time when there was tremendous pressure to control costs, for example, and to increase access and to limit debt. And so there were a lot of pressures on our sector of the economy already. In spite of the fact that the evidence about the value of a college education is unambiguous. It really is unambiguous that in terms of helping prepare people for success in their lives by many different measures, a college education continues to be an extraordinarily good investment. So in spite of that, yeah. I think that we found ourselves, we weren't doing as a community a good enough job sort of making it clear of our value to society in lots of ways. And so we had that before, and then this just puts more pressure on our institutions. State government, public institutions are going to face cuts in their budgets because of the revenue drops as a result of the hit to the economy. We had to reinvent how we function at least for the next year or so with distance, either all distance learning or coming on campus and having distance. And so that those are stressors to the system and real challenges. I mean, our institutions aren't exactly known for changing really quickly. I think as a community, we did an extraordinary job in the fall and in the spring in sending students home, shifting to almost all online. I mean, that was. It's really phenomenal what the community of 3,000 to 4,000 institutions did in this country. So I think that was great, but the pressures are extraordinary, and the uncertainty is the problem.
When you say some may not come out of it here, I'm trying to think. I know Grinnell College, of course, one of the top private colleges in the country, a sizable endowment. What are the characteristics of a college or a university, and I don't want you to name one, but that it may not make it out of this? What would be a bad position to be in if Grinnell is in a good position?
Well, being really dependent on student revenue and having no reserves at all. I mean, that's sort of the worst case scenario, because it's hard to imagine how there won't be drops in revenue at almost every institution in one way or another, except for the most selective and highest brand institutions. So institutions that have no reserve capacity, don't have a tradition of fundraising, a rigorous strong fundraising, and are heavily dependent on revenue from students in order to remain operational.
I don't know a lot about higher ed. I know something about higher ed. That sounds like you're describing a lot of institutions.
I think a lot of institutions are going to be put into a difficult position. I think you're also going to see lots of creativity in all sorts of ways. And so I think that's the broad category of institutions that I think are most vulnerable. But within that community, I think you're going to see a lot of institutions come up with really creative solutions. Now, there have already begun to be some, for example, mergers, and that may happen. I think some institutions may rethink the way they operate and deliver their services in ways that might help them to survive, albeit in a different way. So while I think those pressures are real, and there will be some institutions that will have a hard time surviving through these pressures, I think by and large our institutions are very creative and adaptable and have the capacity to respond to this new world.
Okay. If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour, Raynard Kington, outgoing president of Grinnell College. He's been president of Grinnell College since 2010. So I wanted to tap into your considerable medical background, health policy background, but you're obviously a leader here too, and this crisis calls forth those two qualities. You have so much expertise in this area. A couple months into this crisis, let's perhaps go more to the health area, your health expertise and your leadership expertise with that. What's at the top of your list of concerns during this national health and economic crisis?
Yeah, I think the single biggest concern is our failure to quickly ramp up an infrastructure across the whole country for testing. I think we are slowly, you know, we're sort of ramping up getting tests for example, for antibodies. I think that's sort of, we're still trying to figure out what antibodies mean even. I think we're beginning to, obviously we've already seen some progress with vaccines, although that still is anticipated to take quite some period of time. What I think the biggest concern is testing, access to testing on a really high scale, but also sort of our public health infrastructure. I think this has shown lots of weaknesses in our public health infrastructure, capacity for tracing, for example, contact tracing, and the ability to sort of coordinate across institutions of various types, so that our public health departments can be leaders in helping institutions respond appropriately. So I think that in many ways this has sort of put tremendous pressure on institutions, meaning these sort of public health infrastructure, that have illustrated how we as a society have not invested what we should have invested in that part of our sort of public infrastructure. Right. And we're paying the price for it. We'll pay the price with lives.
Do you have the sense of, I mean, I think a lot of Americans perhaps have the sense of, how did we get caught off guard? It reminded me in the same way, though they're very different catastrophes. We were caught off guard by 9/11. In hindsight, we can say, yeah, it's very easy, relatively easy, if you're willing to give your life, to make a commercial jet into a big bomb. Now this pandemic has changed everything. It is destroying economies. How did we get caught off guard? Or were we not all caught off guard, just leadership was not listening?
I think that this was not a big surprise in many parts of the knowledge world out there. There were groups and professional groups and individuals, knowledgeable people were saying that this was the type of thing that could happen, and we just never responded as a community in preparing for it. So I don't think this is a surprise in in big sections of the sort of the public health world. What the problem was as increasing pressure on government, particularly state-level government, but also at the federal level, I think there was not sufficient funding to public health infrastructure and to public health preparedness across our society, and now we're paying the price. I think Americans have a ability, even when we drop the ball, to sort of catch up. And I think that we have the ability to sort of recover, but this is a painful lesson. That you know, we used to have, I think, a system that was the envy of the world. And with regard to how we as a country and as a society have responded to this extraordinary challenge, I think it's pretty clear we get like a D-.
The ball was dropped by whom? How far back do we go? With succeeding generations of succeeding terms of presidents, this president, the previous president included, how far back do we go when we talk about ball dropping?
Yeah. It's hard for me to say, and I'm reluctant to say.
I understand.
But what can I say, though, is that, you know, there's no question that we as a society just were not prepared and did not respond quickly in lots of ways, and that we're paying the price. Now, the question is, I don't know how productive it is looking back in terms of sort of what we might have done. What the question is, are we willing to pay the price to respond coherently and in a way that protects the health of our society, but also are willing to pay a price in terms of the investments it will take in our public health infrastructure, in additional research infrastructure, in sort of at the federal level and the state level to prepare for the next one.
Just to jump in, is it clear to you, I think as it is to many people, that this will change our society in terms of health policy significantly in the same way the Great Depression changed our society's views of, I guess Social Security came into being then. Will we experience something on that magnitude?
You know, I hope we do, because I'm hoping that all of this pain and suffering in so many ways at so many levels in our society, that there's something that comes out of it that's positive. And what I hope that comes out of it that's positive is, one, the recognition of how intertwined all of our lives are. So this tendency to create this illusion that there those people out there and they're the problem and I'm pretty safe right in my little corner and I don't have to worry about that, I hope that's been revealed that's just not the way the world works anymore. I don't know if it ever worked that way, but what I'm hoping that will come out of this is that we will rethink how we think as a community and as a society about each other, about our responsibility to the collective, because this is about collective response so that all of us are protected, everyone, with mm-hmm. no exceptions or footnotes. Everyone gets protected. And that means that we're going to have to rethink how our society works in so many ways. And if there's anything the positive that comes out of this catastrophe that allows more people to think for a second that maybe my life is tied to every other life in this community, that my ability to do what I want is tied to making sure other people have the ability to sort of live healthy, successful lives, that we're in this together. Maybe it's wishful thinking, but that's my hope, that it will sort of, just as the Great Depression knocked many people sort of and many families in ways that changed their thinking about sort of us and them. And mm-hmm. if I'm hopeful that that's what will come out of this.
Are there examples of leadership either in this country or in the world that I know you don't want to blame, but let's go the other direction. Are there shining examples of leadership from this country or from abroad, other countries during this crisis, where you say, that's it, that leader hit the nail on the head?
I think there are examples of excellence out there. I think Angela Merkel, in Germany, had a evidence-based, maybe it was her scientific background, but it was evidence-based, but not sort of, extreme, I think, in many ways. I think it was an appropriate response. They're thoughtful and relying on science. So I think that I think that they've done reasonably well. So I think there are some examples, and I think we need to sort of look at those examples. And one thing that I found really interesting was that in the absence of strong, consistent, science-based leadership at the national level and at some would say at the state level in a consistent way, in the absence of that, the structures of civil society stepped in many ways. And I think it's sort of, the MBA's canceling of its season probably did as much to educate people as some of the statements from leaders. And I really think that there are examples of society, civil society, I think higher education, the colleges and universities that said, no, we're sending everyone home. Many of them were private institutions that were independently making decisions based on what was best for the collective. It was somewhat gratifying that some of these organizations stepped in and tried to fill a void that was clearly there, because we were not and are not still together as a community. They were still not together as a community, as a society in many ways.
I wanted to finish up, if I could, on a personal note, President Kington. I want to have you react to a passage from an article that you wrote in the Chronicle of Higher Education in 2018. The title of the article, "A Gay African-American Urbanite Finds a Home in Rural Iowa," a little passage from it. Right from the start, "Because I am gay, a gay African-American man in an interracial marriage with kids, Perhaps we were seen as expatriates of a sort, viewed with skepticism or shock by those we left behind for choosing to leave a familiar urban center and greeted with uncertainty or suspicion by those in this part of America. When you think back to when you decided to come to Iowa and the intervening 10 years, how has it shaped you and your family? What will you be? What part of us will you be taking with you? Your husband and your two boys, right?
Well, I think that many of my sort of I shared preconceived notions that a lot of people had about what it meant to live in a rural community, and what I've come out of it with is sort of this realization that obviously was known at some level, but sort of confirmed that, you know, people are people, you'll find the best and the worst of people everywhere. Mm-hmm. And there are many dimensions of small town life that are very positive for and have been positive for me and my family. It was particularly interesting to be at this place at a time when our society, one of the dimensions in which we were separating was between sort of urban and rural, this divide, mm-hmm. politically and economically and socially in many ways. And so it's been a good experience for me to sort of learn to sort of rethink assumptions about what different communities are like. Okay. And my moving here forced me to rethink my assumptions. And I was willing to do that. I'm delighted that our two boys sort of see themselves as Iowans. Yeah. You know, they spend most of their life here in Iowa, and they came at age 1 and 4. And with that comes this sort of the best in Iowa is a long tradition of being open-minded. I think in many ways, the best of Iowa is this sense of open-mindedness and, historically at least, this sense of collective responsibility. I think that's a good thing for my kids to have experienced.
Well, wonderful. Wonderful words to finish up. Thank you very much, Raynard Kington. We wish you, your husband, your kids, all the best going forward. We'll miss you, your leadership in Grinnell College. That would be echoed by I don't know how many people at Grinnell College and that community and people across Iowa. But thank you very much for this conversation and the several conversations we've had over the past 10 years here on Iowa Public Radio.
Thank you for the invitation, and thank you to all the people in our community who have been so kind and welcoming to me and my family over the time. We will never forget it.
Coming up after a short break, we'll hear from the Iowa State Patrol about the increase in the number of speeding tickets, also from the director of the National Advanced Driving Simulator at the University of Iowa. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.